For those who may not have been here today, I'm Dr. Stephen Bauer from Southern Adventist University. I teach theology and ethics there, and hopefully some of you will be seeing at Southern in the near to moderate future. Before we begin, let me have a word of prayer. Lord, as we think tonight about some new things, speak to our hearts in a meaningful way and help us become more like Jesus. I pray in His name. Amen. In my ethics class, I have a little game I call the mouse game. And I'd like to play it for a minute with you all. We ask a question. We're going to take a vote here, okay? The question before the vote here is it okay to torture a mouse sheerly for the joy and happiness it brings you? How many would say, I can torture the mouse? Oh. Right, but the question is it okay to torture it for the joy it can bring you? Oh, yeah. All right. We still got one who's holding her hand up here. Okay. All righty. We'll come back to you in a moment. Okay. How many say not torture the mouse? Okay, I got a majority. All righty. Now, here's the question. On what basis did you make that decision? Okay. 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 Stacy says, if I'm the mouse, I don't want to be tortured. What kind of argument is that?
Yeah. How do you know what it's like to be a mouse?
Okay. Okay, she's a kind of applying a golden rule. If I don't want it done to me, then I should not do it to it, and we're expanding it beyond humans to the mouse. Okay? Any other reasons? By the way, those of you who said it was okay, why was it okay? No, but he's not eating your food. So we're not taking care of the mouse because he's hurting us. We're just doing it because pulling his legs off and whatever else just makes us feel happy. Okay. See, it's actually a very important question. Any other reasons not to torture the mouse? Okay, this is a classic one. It feels pain. And for a lot of people, morally causing pain that is unnecessary is an unjustified action. All right, it's self-evidential to them. Causing pain is bad, so don't cause unnecessary pain. Mouse isn't hurting you. You don't hurt the mouse. Any other reasons? Okay, that's what Stacy was saying. How would you like it if you were the mouse, right? Anybody else? See, now from a Christian perspective, where might we go? Okay, what would Jesus do? That's where I'm ultimately going. Say again. Okay, what are we getting at here? Maybe not quite, because he did say you're of more value than many sparrows. But we're getting to the stewardship issue. The earth is the Lord's. If it's God's mouse and the mouse is not misbehaving, then I should respect God's property and nurture it, right? Of course, now mice can be affected by sin, and then we have to deal with them. But we don't necessarily torture them. Okay? But see, now if you say, hey, I don't want to torture the mouse, and I move to a snake, see, and if you say yes to the snake and no to the mouse, what's the next question I'm going to ask you? What's the difference between the snake and the mouse that lets me? Yeah. But there is one argument that I've not heard anybody talk about. Torturing a creature over whom you have so much superior power, what does that do to who you are? Where do most abusive parents and spouses start? By torturing animals. Yes, I am dead serious. They start by picking on the dog or the cat or the mouse or the snake or even the cockroach. Inflicting unnecessary pain and torture for their own enjoyment because it's a power game. And then when they get bigger, they start to either molest their wife or their children. So very often it starts in hurting and molesting the animal over whom you have power and they cannot fight you back. Question now is, coming from this morning's sermon, does that match the character of our God? And that's what I want to work on now. And I'd like to go to an old passage of the Bible that talked about a big controversy in the Corinthian church. It's a controversy that you and I can't understand as well because we don't have that issue today, at least not openly. And the question was, is it okay to eat meat from an animal that was sacrificed to a pagan idol? Particularly if you were getting that meat from the meat market, as opposed to going up to the temple and eating the cultic feast to that god. And to make a long story short, Paul says you don't go up to the temple to eat the cultic feast because that's like eating with the demons. So the controversy was over whether, you see, they had so many sacrifices at these temples that one of the ways the temples funded their budget was to sell the excess meat to the meat market. Now don't forget they didn't have refrigeration in those days, so meat didn't last that long. So you had a constant supply of fresh meat coming from the cultic sacrifices to the meat market each day so you could buy your food. But there was a good chance some of that food had first been offered to a pagan god. And so the question was, can we as a Christian eat this meat that we bought at Walmart Supercenter, but it was offered to the pagan god? And you can guess that not everybody in the church agreed, right? What's new under the sun? And so we had some who said, those idols are nothing. In fact, those are the ones who said, I can even go up to the temple and eat. The libertines. And we had the others who thought that the meat had some kind of cooties. That if I eat it, I get the cooties and I'm, you know. And so there. And Paul starts to talk to them. And he's talking to them as if he's talking to the one who is more permissive. And so the one who is more permissive is rationalizing, you know, the God of the idol really doesn't exist. We know there's only one God. But he says not everybody understands this. You know, if you were a recent convert from paganism, monotheism would be a new idea to you. Right? You're used to having all sorts of gods, right? And suddenly, one God, and yet you have at least two gods, because Jesus is God, the Father is God, and yet we say there's one God. So you're trying to wrap your mind all around this, right? And being so fresh out of that pagan background, you still have old instincts, right? I'll illustrate it this way. I had a student a number of years ago who came to me after 11 years in the U.S. Army, married with 3 or 4 kids, but he had spent 11 years in the Army. And he'd be walking down the hall in our building, and we got a pretty good hall, you know, goes like from me to the back wall, and my office is down here. He'd come around the corner, start down the hall, and I'd see him coming, and I'd go, "Ten Hut!" And he... Old instincts, right? Because after 11 years in the Army, when you hear the call to attention, you know, you just do it. So I got him a bunch of times. But after 4 years at Southern, it started to lose its charm because he had enough time out of the Army that the instincts weren't so... See, so when you're a fresh convert, those old instincts about multiple gods and so forth, this is a sensitive issue about eating meat from the meat market. And so Paul says to this man who thinks he can eat, he says, don't only take care, I'm in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 9, if you want to put it on the screen, only take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you, a man of knowledge, at table in an idol's temple, might he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak man is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died, thus sinning against your brethren, wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. What's going on here? Each of us has a sphere of personal power in which there are others weaker than us around us in our sphere of influence. There are also some that are more powerful than us, but I'm not dealing with that tonight. I'm dealing with you as the agent of personal power. And each of us have power over someone who is weaker than us, and we have power to damage them, and they have no power to resist. And the question now is, how are you going to use your personal power? And the libertines in the Corinthian church said, I'm going to use my power to exercise my right to do as I please, don't get in my way. I don't care what it does to you. And I don't care what it does to you. It's my right. Get out of my way and let me do it. And Paul comes along with a radical idea. Because he says, when you act that way, you wound this weaker brother by your power, and thus you sin against Christ, because in this context you might make them lose their faith and go back to their paganism and be lost. That's a heavy thought, isn't it? So Paul continues now in verse 13. Therefore, if food is a cause of my brother's falling, I won't even eat meat. You catch the point? What did Paul say he's really willing to do then? Go vegetarian! If eating meat from the meat market is going to cause my brother to lose his way with Christ, Paul says, I won't even touch the stuff, I'll go vegetarian for the sake of the weaker brother. How is he using his power? How is he using his power? To help the weaker brother, not to hurt, right? And what's he doing to help the weaker brother? He's giving up his right, his liberty to eat the meat even though I have the liberty to, I'm not going to, because if my liberty is going to hurt you, I'll give up my liberty to protect you. Is that a radical way of thinking? Is that the kind of thinking you find in the world around you today? I think the world around us is much more like the libertine brother. Get out of my way. It's my right. Don't be offended, right? And to illustrate the principle, in chapter 9, Paul now uses himself and Barnabas as an example of this principle of saying, even though I have the right and the ability, if it's going to damage, I won't exercise my rights. Where did he get that from, by the way? See, those of you who are here this morning for what was wrong with Lindsay Lohan, what do we talk about? Who, being in very nature God, did not cling to equality with God, but emptied himself. And I think for Paul, this is the grandest moral principle in the universe. And he drills it to the Corinthians in one verse. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9. Do we have the screen on that one? 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, see, that's all the power and privileges, right? That though he was rich, yet for your sake he became what? Poor, so that by his poverty you might become. See, this is Philippians 2, 5 to 8, condensed into one verse. And Paul marveled at a God who has the right never to encounter the concept of no, who said no to himself and gave up his rights to help you and me, his enemy. That just blew Paul's mind. And Paul now takes this concept of Christ giving up his kingly power and his rights and becoming the slave to save his enemies and bring them back to himself. He takes that and he makes it a moral way of life for the Christian. And his first point was then, if you're eating the meat is going to make your brother lose his salvation, you're better off being a vegetarian. Don't exercise the right to eat the meat. And now he shows them how he has already practiced this moral principle with them in chapter 9, back in 1 Corinthians. Now, and he opens the chapter, am I not free? Am I not an apostle? What's an apostle? This is someone the church recognizes as a spiritually authoritative figure, right? Kind of like our conference president or something. The pastor. He said, I'm an apostle. Haven't I seen the Lord Jesus Christ? Aren't you my workmanship? Paul had planted this church, right? Now we get to his point in verse 4. Do we not have a right to our food and drink? What did Paul... How did Paul pay his bills in Corinth? Does anybody know? He was a tent maker, right? What does that tell you? He was supporting himself with a trade. He was not being paid by the Corinthian church. And he starts to make a legal and moral case why he has the right to be paid by the Corinthian church. And he says the other apostles get paid. They get to take their wives on the trips that they take. Don't I get to take someone with me? We give all these other guys paychecks. I don't have one. I'm making tents. Why? Who works at his own expense? He even goes to Old Testament law and he says, even oxen get paid for their work, right? You don't muzzle the ox when it's treading the grain, right? You know, they would put an oxen on they had a post in the ground, and you put a swivel on the top so that it made the ox walk in a circle around the post. And the grain was cut on the, on the stalks. And so you would put it on the ground, and as the ox walks around, stomping on the grain, it breaks the wheat kernels or the barley kernels out loose. And so you want to get maximum harvest to take to market, right? So they would muzzle the ox so he wouldn't be able to eat what he's walking on. Old Testament law says you don't muzzle the ox. He gets to eat while he walks. So he says even oxen get paid in God's system for their work. And the church pays apostles. And no one goes to battle in the army at their own expense. They get paid, right? So what's he saying? Barnabas and I have a right to be paid by you. Verse 12, partway through, about halfway through. Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel. And you go three more verses to 15. He goes to the first person singular. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing to secure any such provision. For I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground of boasting. What's his point? How would being paid by the Corinthians have hindered the gospel? You have to understand Corinthian culture. Corinthian culture was a culture that took advantage of their geography to rip people off. You see, the coastline of Greece came kind of down like this. And on the other side, it came down like this to a little point about 4 miles wide. And then it went out into a big bulbous, almost island. And ancient shipping did not have GPS, right? So you followed the coast. That meant you had to come down, 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 around, round, 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 and keep going. That was expensive because it took many days to get around. The Corinthians figured out that you could unload the boat, carry the stuff 4.5 miles to the other side, hire a different boat, and at normal wages, that would have been very inexpensive, but they knew how much it cost to go around, right? So they gouged you so that you saved a little bit of money, but not as much as you should have saved to go across. Cutthroat business, right? If I can get away with it. Also, all the people were in there just short time like a ship captain. You rip them off. By the time he figures it out, he's 2 days out to sea and not coming back. See, you have the power to disadvantage someone, to victimize someone, and the power to get away with it. And so you had a bunch of predators in Corinth who took advantage of people in business. And so they had lots of lawsuits. Sounds a lot like our society, right? Corinth was very American. Very American. Modern America here. Furthermore, in this rip them off, make the fast buck while you can make it, there were a bunch of religious shysters promising all sorts of heavenly blessings and getting rich off the people. If Paul takes money from the Corinthians to teach them about Jesus, they're just going to think he's another one of those shysters. So to prove to them the freeness of grace, Paul says, I'm going to give you the gospel for free. I'm not going to let you pay me. I'm going to pay myself. I have the right to be paid, but if I exercise that right, it's going to hinder your ability to be saved. Therefore, I'm not going to exercise my right. I'm going to pay myself and work. Where did he get that from? He got it from Philippians 2, from a God who emptied himself of his rights to help others in need and put their need more important than his rights. And Paul makes an ethics out of this, and he uses himself and Barnabas as the example. Look how we've modeled not exercising rights to help you get this bigger picture. Now, on this food offered to idols, I want you to do like Barnabas and me and empty yourself of your right and protect the weaker brother. Instead of preying on the weaker brother, protect him. You see, who is in your sphere of power? Are you going to be the predator or the protector? Which one is Jesus like? Is he the predator or the protector? He's the protector, isn't he? He's the one who gave up his rights to protect the weak and the needy. And Paul uses the same logic. Remember from church service. In the pagan mind, the gods made man to be slaves to serve the gods. And when man got too noisy, let's wipe him out with pestilence and disease to shut him up. Whereas Jesus said, the people I made for fellowship with me have sinned, they've fallen. They have fallen under judgment and condemnation, and they deserve to be annihilated for their rebellion against the principles of the universe. But I love them so much, I'm going to give up my rights as God and become the slave so I can save them. And Paul said he did this because of the kind of God he was. And so Paul uses the same logic. It's because he's an apostle of Christ that he follows Christ in giving up his rights to bless the Corinthians. Our musicians can start moving. So why should I not torture the mouse? Because if I torture the mouse, I am using my power in a predatory way that is unlike Christ. Now, just as Christ will punish the incorrigibly rebellious, there are times when the mice are in my cabinet eating my food that I have to take on the mouse. But even then, I take on the mouse in a way that I hope causes the least amount of pain and suffering to the mouse, which is why I don't use glue traps, for example, because they sit there for days starving to death and dehydrating to death. Okay, let's get it over with, right? But when the mouse is not eating my food, I'm called to care for God's creation. I'm called to care for the weak and to inconvenience myself. Who are the weak in your sphere of influence? See, it's easy to write letters to the governor of the state about the weak in some city, right? It's easy to write letters to President Obama about the weak in Boston or the weak in Los Angeles. But the question is, how are you treating the ones that you have power over? Maybe it's just the goldfish and the cat and the frog in your pond. How are you going to treat them? Are you going to treat them with the self-sacrificial, self-emptying love of Jesus? Or are you going to lord it over them for your own pleasure? That's the question. May we join the greatest story ever told about a God who chose to let go of his divine privileges to save enemies who deserve death and bring them back into fellowship. May that govern how we treat the weak in our sphere of our personal power.